Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Adding up the stimulus 5 years on, old-style apprenticeships in the startup world, and sleeves in the NBA? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From APM in New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Monday, February 17th, President's Day. It is good to have you with us. 5 years ago today, President Obama signed the stimulus into law, formally called the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Roughly $800 billion meant to save or create 3.5 million jobs. The stimulus was controversial from the start, and 5 years later, still not a lot of agreement on what it actually did. Marketplace's David Gura joins me to talk about it. Hi, David.
Hey, Lizzie.
Wind the clock back for me and look out on February of 2009 to what that economic landscape was looking like. It was pretty bleak.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. An economist I talked to said it was more or less in a shambles. And so here, you know, unemployment was just over 8%, and it only got worse. In the next few months, it got up to 10%. So I think it's important when we talk about the stimulus and what it was able to do to talk about sort of the baseline, what was happening to the economy generally, and the people who created the stimulus, who wanted the stimulus, who fought for it. They say now that nobody could have predicted how bad the U.S. economy overall would get over the next couple of years.
The White House made some pretty bold promises about what the stimulus might be able to head off. And the big question 5 years later is, did it deliver on its economic promises?
Yeah, so the big promises here were to break the recession, which had been ongoing, which, as I said, was getting worse, and to get the recovery started. So there's some big goals. And the way that the White House wanted to go about doing that was to give some money to states, which were pretty cash-strapped, to provide more money for job training for people to go back to school who may have lost their jobs, and to fund these sort of big shovel-ready infrastructure projects across the country. There have been a lot of studies about how well that worked. There were some big claims early on that the stimulus would create 3.5 million jobs. The numbers really vary widely. They're all over the map. I think that what critics say most is that it's impossible for us to say sort of what would have happened if we didn't have the stimulus. In other words, there was no counterfactual. And this is something I talked about with Alan Blinder, who's an economist at Princeton.
In terms of politics, it's an overwhelming hurdle that can't be crossed.
So 5 years later, you still have politicians on both sides of the aisle fighting about this. An anniversary is always a good chance for them to keep doing that. What critics say is this was a lot of money spent on a lot of projects. There might not have been as much accountability as they'd like. And maybe some of these projects that were supposed to be shovel ready weren't as shovel ready as they should have been.
Democrats and the White House would like to do more of this. That's a very tough lift on Capitol Hill. Is there any evidence, given that we're still in a fairly anemic place, A, that that's possible, and B, that it would have any effect?
Yeah, I mean, the economy is still weak, and of course, it's not 2009 weak, but there are still plenty of people who are out of work, who still haven't been able to find jobs. President Obama called for more spending on infrastructure in his most recent State of the Union. This is money that could be used to fix more infrastructure, to build new infrastructure, to work on IT infrastructure. I think his point, and this is shared by a lot of politicians on both sides of the aisle, is that if you look at the state of American infrastructure, it's pretty bad. It's certainly not any better than it was in 2009. But as you say, I think that getting Congress behind him on doing this is going to be a really big challenge for him. And it doesn't look that likely right now.
Marketplace's David Gura talking to us from Washington on the 5-year anniversary of the stimulus. Thank you, David.
Thanks.
Wall Street Today was closed, but we'll have some of our own numbers a little later in the show. Here in New York, we had a welcome day of sunshine today. But a storm that's been lashing the Midwest is headed northeast. It's just more nasty weather that we've learned can turn voices like mine a little throatier than usual, and much more importantly, hurt the economy. This winter, we've reported on how freezing weather means smaller paychecks for part-time workers, fewer customers in stores, and manufacturing delays. But there are a handful of industries that actually thrive in brutal weather. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
Of course, snowplow drivers make a killing, but many others profit from storms, including giant corporations. Campbell's stock soared Friday on better-than-expected earnings, driven in part by surging soup sales. And while folks spoon their chicken in stars, they're streaming a lot of video, says Todd Smith of cable company Cox Communications.
In the Southeast region, on-demand usage increased by more than 30%.
The hope for Cox and other media companies is people stuck at home might get turned on to faster broadband or premium channels. Now, at some point, people must brave the icy outside world. They'll have to go shopping for serious coats, gloves, and boots, like in this guy's store.
It's been great. Can't complain at all.
Bob Levy is president of Dave's New York, an outerwear store that loves a strong winter. Sales are up about 10%. But he says the company might have doubled that increase.
We could have sold a lot more if some of the suppliers actually had more.
Like a lot of retailers in the Northeast, his customers need new boots for their frozen toes. But he can't get enough. That's because today's manufacturers are built extra lean to keep expenses down. Harvard Business School logistics professor Anant Raman says that means many don't have extra workers or materials sitting around if they need to make more boots.
You realize you don't have leather, you don't have the sole. You don't have all the components, and you don't also have factories that are sitting ready to go.
And those boots may not be ready before spring. Too late to turn snowfall into windfall. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Another train carrying crude oil derailed and spilled last week, this time in western Pennsylvania. As more and more oil is transported by rail, critics want mandatory safety standards for oil tanker cars. Currently, the regulations are voluntary. But two Canadian railroad companies have decided not to wait for a regulatory change. They're using economic incentives to reward safety. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, David Weinberg reports.
Train wrecks are a nightmare for railroad companies. Not only do they put tracks out of service during the cleanup, but they're also PR disasters, especially when they involve environmental catastrophes. One way to prevent hazardous spills is to use newer tank cars, ones that were built to safety standards created in 2011. Railroad engineer Tom Johnson gave me a little virtual tour of an oil tank car.
With the new design tank cars, there's three major changes.
Let's start with the manway cover, the part of the train where the oil is poured in from the top. Newer cars have much stronger covers to keep oil inside in the event of a crash. They also have thicker steel and stronger welds that make the tanks less susceptible to punctures.
And thirdly, there's a heat shield. There's one that covers the profile of the front of the car and one that covers the profile of the back of the car.
These prevent fires from spreading from car to car. The newer cars cost way more, and regulators don't require their use. So Canadian Pacific and Canadian National Railway have both announced that they will be charging extra for customers who ship oil in older cars. Canadian National said in a statement that they have restructured their rates to create an economic incentive for customers to make the switch. Gary Hunter, president of Railroad Industries Incorporated, says even if the incentives work, though, companies won't be able to get new cars anytime soon.
You're looking at 2 to 3 years now to get new cars built because there's just that much of a backlog.
Only 15% of the roughly 92,000 tank cars that transport flammable liquids meet the new safety standards. With oil production booming in the U.S. and Canada, one possible result of the surcharge is that companies may abandon railroads altogether and look for other ways to transport crude. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
If I wanted to rent a movie tonight, piece of cake. Two buttons on my remote control and there it is. But that on-demand speed just isn't there yet in the world of money. Even if, say, you pay your electric bill online on a Thursday, the transaction may not be completed until the following Monday. That's because the technology banks use to send and receive funds all dates way back to the 70s and 80s. Kevin Wack is a reporter for American Banker, and he's been reporting on why payments in the U.S. are so slow.
If you lived in the U.K., here's how long it would take to wire £50 to a friend.
1-1,000, 2-1,000.
Count to 10, and the money's there. In Sweden, it happens even faster, about 6 seconds. Then there's the USA.
10-1,000.
Here we measure the speed of electronic payments in days. The good news is that the U.S. Federal Reserve does realize we've fallen way behind. Last fall, the central bank laid out a vision of the future. That vision looks a lot like where Sweden already is today. But the biggest American banks are throwing cold water on the Fed's idea. They argue that any overhaul should pay for itself. The problem with that is banks will initially have to spend millions to upgrade their computer systems.
I think you have to see this as an investment an industry makes to meet the needs of its customers.
Craig Tillotson is managing director of Britain's Faster Payments Scheme. In the year ahead, he expects Brits to make more than a billion online payments through the service.
It's better for the provider of service. They get the money more quickly. And frankly, it's more convenient and easier for consumers because they just go online and make the payment.
The holy grail of person-to-person payments is the ability to send money instantaneously to anyone's mobile phone number. In Sweden, that's been reality for over a year now. The Swedes call their system Swish.
You can use your mobile phone that you use in thousands of other situations. Now you also can use it for the payment to your friends and your children and whatsoever.
Lars Gunstam is an executive at the Swedish bank Nordea. He also heads the group that runs Swish. He says the upgrades have a lot of practical uses. You can split a dinner bill while still sitting in the restaurant. Or think about someone like a food truck owner who normally wastes a lot of time handling cash.
He can immediately see that he has received the money and you can shake hands and say, fine, done. That is very important if you do business out in the street.
Innovation is happening here in the U.S. too. New services like Pop Money and Chase Quick Pay allow you to send money to a friend over your mobile device. But in terms of fast payments, they don't even come close to linking every U.S. bank and credit union. Lars Gunstam says America would benefit by following Sweden's example.
The social media, the blog world, had been extremely positive, and that is quite unusual for a bank, I can promise you.
For U.S. banks, that kind of glowing PR may be a long way off. The Federal Reserve's vision for completing that payments overhaul we talked about earlier? It's still a decade away. I'm Kevin Wack for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Not everyone can pull off sleeveless apparel, whereas most everyone can feel comfortable in a t-shirt.
What's up with those jerseys NBA players were wearing at the All-Star game last night? But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed for the President's Day holiday, although technically they were closed for George Washington's birthday, the real name of the holiday. We only started calling it President's Day after retailers decided that George Washington's birthday sales, hard to say, was hard to put on a sign or in banners. Here are some numbers on our forefathers. James Madison, the shortest president, 5 feet 4 inches tall, weighing less than 100 pounds. Abraham Lincoln was the tallest, 6 foot 4 inches. William Howard Taft, no surprise, the heaviest, weighing in at 325 pounds. Overseas, there were some markets open. In Germany, the DAX slipped less than a 10%. London's FTSE had a strong showing, up a full percent. France's CAC 40 trickled down a 10%. In Asia, Tokyo's Nikkei jumped a 0.5%, and the Hang Seng in Hong Kong was up a percent. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. The National Association of Home Builders releases its housing index for the month of February. And has a blast of snow cooled down manufacturing in the Northeast? We'll find out with the release of the Empire Manufacturing Index. You think we're having crazy weather? In 1979, snow fell in the Sahara Desert for the only time in recorded history. I'm Denise Guerra.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. Entrepreneurship has become a big buzzword lately, but for young people, it can be hard to know where to start. Andrew Yang wants to change that. He's the CEO of Venture for America, an organization that works to get new college grads to work in startups across the country. And he's written a book called Smart People Should Build Things. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You describe yourself as a recovering lawyer. How did you end up where you are now?
Well, I found the law wasn't a great fit for me, and so I ended up transitioning to startup companies, including a national education company that was acquired by the Washington Post. And when I was at that company, I realized that there was a profound issue with the flow of talent in the U.S., where we have tons of very smart young people every year heading to professional services, that is finance, consulting, law, and not enough talent heading to the businesses and industries that employ those firms and also are going to end up determining the direction of our economy over the long haul.
Lots of folks now say, I want to learn how to code. I want to build an app. I want to start a startup. Is there a possibility that you could have too many of them without the right training to know how to execute on that?
There's something of a misperception that all startups require is engineers and coders, and that if you are not in that particular subset of people, then startups are not for you. But early stage companies need talented salespeople, customer support, management, operations, marketing, administration. They need talented people at every part of the organization in a variety of roles. So even if someone's not an engineer by training, there are tons of things they can do at these firms.
How do you teach someone to work in those companies where they're actually doing and making stuff?
Well, you need young people who have very high ceilings and are willing to learn and adapt. Because oftentimes with an early stage company, you haven't actually precisely figured out the nature of the roles. And so you want to hire someone who can figure them out with you and hopefully evolve and grow as the company grows.
You've got a passage in the book about what sort of experience you'd suggest to a 22-year-old who would want to run or start their own business, but doesn't know how to do it.
What we suggest is that the best way to learn how to build a business is to work with someone who's doing that very thing, is to become an apprentice or lieutenant to a more experienced entrepreneur that's in the process of developing their own company.
In a lot of ways, this is a pretty old-fashioned concept, right? I mean, this goes back to being a journeyman tradesman, really.
Yeah, we certainly believe in the power of mentorship, and we think that that for entrepreneurship in particular, that's a great way to learn, is to be supportive of a more experienced veteran entrepreneur.
You've set a pretty ambitious target for job growth. How do you do that?
Well, for all of the discussion around job growth, we think it's pretty straightforward how you achieve it. Early stage companies account for about 2/3 of new net jobs in the U.S. So helping those companies reach a point where they're in expansion mode is a huge driver of potential job growth. The second thing we need to do is we need to train more of our best and brightest to themselves become entrepreneurs and business builders. Right now, we don't have enough smart people building things. We're training our smart people to become facilitators and advisors as opposed to builders.
Yeah, but a lot of those companies, early stage companies, fail. So how do you keep them going?
Certainly, my first company did not work out. And so I learned from that. I got up and I tried again. And over time, I found that you learn and you get stronger. So we can't make our young people afraid of failure. We have to let them know that failure is going to be part of the process if they're going to build anything worthwhile.
Andrew Yang is the author of Smart People Should Build Things. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
In his State of the Union speech last month, the president promised a whole new way of dealing with the digital divide. More students with broadband access, more computers in classrooms, upgrading schools across the country. There's a cautionary tale, though, in Los Angeles, where the city's promise to give iPads to all its students is creating a lot of unexpected and expensive complications. KPCC's Annie Gilbertson reports.
Sure, the LA School District has its iPad skeptics, but it also has its fans. Students say iPads are the coolest thing since sliced pepperoni pizza.
I felt excited. I couldn't wait until I got here.
Amore Hurlston and her classmates at Baldwin Hills Elementary say iPads couldn't come soon enough.
I couldn't sleep.
On the big day, her teacher, Jacqueline Porter Morris, wheels out a cart full of iPads. Each one costs $770.
A lot of them don't actually have technology at home, and so it's opening up a whole new world for them.
Porter Morris says it's the biggest classroom change in her 22 years of teaching, and it's happening all over the country. Districts in San Diego, Charlotte, and Las Vegas hope new computers will mean new and better ways to learn. But there have been hiccups. Students quickly bypassed internet blocks to log on to social media and watch videos. other iPads turned up missing. If LA is a test drive, President Obama's new digital learning initiative may have a bumpy road ahead. The president pledged to double the dollars for school internet and bring companies like AT&T and Microsoft to pony up some tech. Apple alone pledged $100 million, but it stands to make a lot more in profits.
As schools go more and more online, the market gets bigger and bigger.
Hofstra University education professor Alan Singer says this isn't philanthropy, it's positioning.
We're talking about megabucks, and we're talking about global expansion.
So how many megabucks are we talking about? Here's a calculation from the back of a napkin. If every American public school kid got an iPad, expect to pay $25 billion. The moment iPads arrived at Baldwin Hills Elementary, students began snapping photos and eagerly testing apps. Guys, stick to the education apps. In Los Angeles, I'm Annie Gilbertson for Marketplace.
If you caught the NBA's All-Star game last night, you would, of course, have seen the East win 163-155, but you would have also seen something else. Shirts with sleeves. No usual tank top-style jerseys. These are slightly tighter, more like something a soccer player wears. Alicia Jessup covers the business of sports for Forbes and the Huffington Post. Alicia, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
When you looked at these guys last night, what was your reaction?
Well, I think since we've seen them several times before, the surprise is less than it was. But I'm still not on board with the sleeve jerseys. I'm a basketball loyalist and traditionalist. And so these men, their arms are strong enough that they should be shown completely. And let's get rid of the sleeves.
Well, there are these comments. I mean, I look at them. You know, Twitter's not indicative of everything. But when they went through, they look like pajamas. They're atrocious. They're just a way to sell more jerseys. But maybe more pointedly, some players don't like them. How did they come about?
Right. So the first NBA team that actually debuted the sleeve jerseys was the Golden State Warriors. And if there's anyone to credit or blame, depending upon what side you're on, with these sleeve jerseys, it would be Rick Welts. So Rick right now is the president and COO of the Warriors, but prior to that, he was an executive in the NBA league office in New York, and he has come out publicly and said that nearly 30 years ago, he and the then deputy commissioner of the NBA had a conversation about how to bring sleeved jerseys into the game. Ultimately, that conversation ended pretty quickly because they didn't have the technology and performance to make it happen. But in 2006, the NBA signed an 11-year apparel deal with Adidas. And recently, Adidas has created something called the Climate Cool Ventilation System. And Rick Welts and NBA leaders believe that this ventilation system was good enough that NBA players could actually wear sleeve jerseys and not heat up too much or not be too weighted down with them.
Why does the league want them to wear sleeve jerseys?
Whenever a league, a team, or an apparel company does something new and innovative, you know that at the end of the day, what they're trying to do is drive revenue. So your executives in the NBA, your Adidas designers, believe that this is a trend that the marketplace wants. I think you can really trace it back to soccer. Those players, they wear sleeved uniforms. So Adidas, you know, probably showed the data to the NBA about the sales of those sleeved uniforms and said, why don't we tinker with this? Why don't we put these on your players for a few games and see how they do in the American market?
Is there an opportunity here, like soccer, where we could start to see sponsors' names be on that little extra space over the shoulders?
Absolutely. About a year ago, the NBA approved advertising on its jerseys, and the new commissioner, Adam Silver, he has already said that we can expect advertising on NBA jerseys, and he's estimated the revenue to be driven from that advertising at $100 million.
Adidas has said they don't have a grand plan to, you know, put these everywhere in the league. They want strategic partnerships, games like the All-Star game. How do you think this is going to unfold in the future?
I think even though Adidas says they do not have a grand plan, they do. They have managed to get their hands on some of the biggest and most televised events of the NBA season with these sleeve jerseys. So I think there's a very clear message being sent that whether the players like it or not, this is a path that the league and Adidas are going to travel down for some time.
Alicia Jessup covers sports business for Forbes and the Huffington Post. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the show today is a statistic that probably would have shocked Julia Child. Turns out that one out of every two sandwiches sold in France is now a hamburger. Le hamburger, if you want to be precise. Our friends at Quartz wrote up a study showing hamburger popularity in France has surged since 2000. Almost a billion of them were sold in that country last year, mostly at fast food places like McDonald's. So go ahead, Pulp Fiction fans, order a Royale with cheese. Although technically, they just call them Royale cheese over there. All right, that's it. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. U.S. markets were closed today for the President's Day holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, and Denise Guerra. Millie Jefferson directs the show. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and we'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.